This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/grapenation.
Hello, this is Sam from the Grape Nation. This past winter, I had the good fortune to attend the Naples Winter Wine Festival and sit down with some of the best people in wine and have done a series of interviews. This week, we're going to be talking to two of the most powerful people in wine, Saskia de Rothschild from Domaine Barons de Rothschild and Laura Catena from Bodega Catena Zapata. Enjoy. Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey on the Heritage Radio Network. We are at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. I'm very excited about our next guest. Our guest is Saskia de Rothschild. She is the youngest person, I'm going to pat you on the back a little now. She's the youngest person to currently lead a first growth Bordeaux estate, her family's Chateau Lafite Rothschild, and also the first female chairwoman of Domaine Barons de Rothschild. Welcome to the Great Nation, Saskia. There's a lot more going on, but those are fairly in the past few years, recent happenings, and you know, very important. Tell me a couple things. You were not always in wine, and you were not always in France, which is really what your family, or on the wine side, is in France and in wine. Tell me a little about your journey in life in wine. Before you got to this, you were doing some interesting things. So tell me a little about that, that got you to where you are.
So I grew up in France, mostly in the vineyards and in Paris, and spending a lot of time in Italy because my mother is an Italian artist. And I always had a special link with the estates, and I was going to do the harvest in the summers, and I would spend time there to see my dad. And I knew there was something extraordinary in those places, and I learned to drink wine and taste wine from a very early age, so that might shock Americans a little bit. But
I mean, the more guests I have, that's the culture and the upbringing.
Yeah, that was
plus it's the family.
Exactly, that was really our culture, and we were taught to close our eyes and to really learn to distinguish different vintages, to know what we liked, what we didn't like, and I think when you're young, you have a very sensitive palate, and you learn a lot and you remember things. So it was a great upbringing to have that. But then my goal in life and what I really wanted to do was to tell stories. So I traveled a little bit around the world and had the chance to be able to do a master's degree in journalism at Columbia University, which taught me a lot about the way Americans see journalism, which is the right way.
So you were in New York for a few years.
Yeah, I was in New York for a few years and learned a lot about how to fact check a story and properly write one.
Were you in the School of Journalism?
Yeah.
Which is one of the best in the country.
Yeah, I was there, and it was a great opportunity to do stories. I did a big documentary series on female Marines leaving for Afghanistan. So I spent some time on Camp Lejeune in North Carolina with these women, and it was absolutely very interesting. And then I had the chance to, a few years later, to get a job at the New York Times. So I worked first at the Paris office of the International New York Times, and then in West Africa. So
tell me one thing. When you finished Columbia, you pretty much left New York?
No, I stayed on for 1 year because I got a...
But not a long time.
No, so just for 1 year.
Right. So you're at the Times in Paris. You're, what'd you say, in West Africa?
Yeah, I traveled to Ivory Coast, I was the correspondent there for a short period of time between they had two correspondents coming, and that was really interesting because it was covering the whole region, even if it's not a critical region for the American reader.
It's an interesting region.
It was really fascinating, and I was
it opens your eyes.
Yeah, I was covering everything from terrorist attacks to elections to what was happening in the prisons and the overcrowded prisons of Ivory Coast, and I traveled to Mali and to Ethiopia, and so it was.
So what year are we at? I mean, where are we at?
It's 2015 or 2016.
Not that long ago.
Yeah, and it was at that point I had been coming back to Bordeaux every year because I was living in New York and around for the blending of Lafitte, because my father always said,
"You have to be there."
You have to be there. That's how you learn what we're doing. Blending Bordeaux wine is part of what we do. So it's good that you come and attend. So I was doing that,
Wait, tell me one thing. Did you would never go there begrudgingly, but did you go there knowing eventually you would come back, or did your father make you do it because he always hoped that this is, I mean, what was the dynamic then?
It was, what's great is that I never felt forced to do it. It was really like, come and see what we do.
Perfect way to do it.
And but then one day, and it was when I was living in Ivory Coast, it was the trip I took to Pauillac that year, and he told me, you know, one day you're gonna have to come back a bit more than just once a year for the blending. And I said, well, I'll have to think about it. And I traveled back to West Africa, and I gave it a thought. And
when you decided.
That's when I decided that I
commit yourself.
Yeah, and it was a big commitment because it was going from a life of total autonomy and independence and traveling to a life of actually having a huge responsibility on my shoulders. And
so this was 15 or 16.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
And when I took that decision, it was really because I felt I was the right person to protect the places I loved, and all these vineyards to me were extremely important. And I felt that
they were part of your past, present, future.
Yeah.
Culture,
so.
Life.
So I took that decision, and the only thing I told him is, well, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna really dedicate my time to doing it full time. And one important thing to me was going back to school to learn viticulture and oenology. So I enrolled in the BTSA, which is a diploma that you get in France and that allows you legally to be running a winery or vineyard. So I enrolled in that and spent 1 year studying that. Normally it's a 2-year program once you have already.
Was it important? I mean, did you embed yourself in it? It was important that you understood what was
super important. And
you didn't
do
it just for the certificate.
You
needed to get up to speed, right?
Yeah, it's the reason I did it is that obviously you need to understand what you're talking about to make important decisions that will affect your vineyard permanently. You know, the way you end up pruning your vineyard, the way you fertilize your soil has an effect that is not just for the vintage
right.
of the year right after. Right. It will have an effect for years to come. So
it's based on science,
I felt
analysis,
that
research.
Even if there was a lot of great technicians who were working with us, I needed to know in order to ask them questions. So it was really useful. And
all right, so you get that under your belt.
Mm-hmm.
You're running around the vineyards when you're a kid. You get out of your system doing what you wanted to do all over the world. You come back. So now there's this generational handover.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Recently, why and when? I mean, why did it happen when it happened? You were ready, your dad. I think everything happened quickly here.
It happened in a very natural way, more than quickly. It happened, so I started working at Lafitte in 2016, and I spent the two first years, so at the same time I was studying for this diploma and spending my whole time there learning all the basic tasks that a vineyard requires, from
right.
pruning to being in the cellar and all tasks that go on during a year. And I spent 1 year doing that. I spent 1 year also traveling a lot to the different estates we had. It was a key moment.
All over the world, right?
Yeah, it was a key moment in the development of our Chinese estates. I really, really embraced that and helped my father with all of that development. And
I was going to ask you later about that, but we're on it. I mean, we know the Chinese market blew up for wine. We know probably the original most beloved wine was Chateau Lafite Rothschild. And next thing you know, what is it, 10 years later or whatever, you have a winery there, right?
Yeah.
It's called?
Long Dai.
L-O-N-G-D-A-I.
Which are two Chinese characters that mean the chiseled mountain.
So tell me the thinking behind that. You could make as much wine as you can or you want to, and you could use China as a market to import, great market. And or you could open a winery there. Is it just because it's such an emerging market that likes wine you want to?
I think the reasoning behind actually going there was really, as you said, Chateau Lafite was a very renowned brand there. And it was saying, look, we love your country. We know you love wine. And we want to be part of the story of Chinese viticulture. And so we started going there and looking around and looking at different soils and mapping and looking what could be done and thinking, well, we could do something great here. We found terroir that we thought was interesting in Shandong, which had the right elevation, which was near the Yellow Sea, so it had oceanic climate. And when we found that, we were like, we're never going to do a Bordeaux in China. That's not the objective. The objective is to
right.
understand.
And you have to work with what's there, not what
yeah.
you want.
Exactly.
So you found the best opportunity.
Yeah, and that was always what we wanted to do, was understand what was there and learn from it, because we found this vineyard in Shandong in the Kushan Valley, and it's a region where there's a lot of apple orchards. And what was great is the area where we decided to plant, there's a village nearby, and so it's called the village of Mulango. And so we worked with all of the villagers to train them to prune. And so the vineyard manager of Chateau Lafite, Mathieu, came in and actually trained all these Chinese women to prune the vines. And
is anyone else in wine doing it to that detail and level?
Honestly, the vineyard we have in China is the most well-kept vineyard I've ever seen.
Like
it's incredible. And it's
smart.
It's a lot big to do with the people we met there and their skills, because they're the ones who knew how to build the hand-built terraces that we ended up mapping our vineyard around. And you know, we have 25 hectares, which is about
60.
Yeah,
58
yeah. Something like 50 acres. So it's not a huge. It's quite small. We have 350 terraces.
That's the way it's set
yeah,
up?
Yeah, that's the way it's set up, a little bit like rice paddies or like the
Isn't
images.
Isn't that difficult?
It's a lot of work to farm, because you have to have, so we have very small tractors that can go in onto those very little terraces. And it's really like very precise work, and each terrace is different, and it's very old granitic soil type.
What are you growing there?
So Cabernet Sauvignon is our main grape.
And it acclimates well to climate, the soil?
Absolutely. We were really, really proud and happy to see that it did well. We imported some of the clones that we knew worked well and that we had seen that would behave right with the soils. And the two other grapes that we've had great success with are Marcelin, which is a grape that the Chinese actually really like, and they've a little bit made their own, like the Argentinians have made Malbec their
yeah.
key grape.
It's interesting.
And so it's a hybrid from the southeast of France, and so Marcelin has good results, and Cabernet Franc, which is a grape that I personally love.
I like it straight up, and
yeah.
I like it blended.
Exactly.
It is
so
a great grape.
So those are the three components of our blend, and we've been working on releasing having a good wine, a good enough wine to release it, and that
so
happened.
So nothing's been released yet?
It has, actually, because so in 2016, 2017, we were working towards, we wanted to release our first wine on the 8th of 2018, because the 8 is a important number, but after really analyzing the quality of the 2016 vintage, we thought, well, it's not good enough. We have to wait one more year.
Right.
So we ended up...
You're anxious, but you want to do it right.
Yeah, you know, it takes... Time in wine is crucial. And the most important thing was to actually explain to the Chinese that releasing a wine doesn't take 5 minutes. They were on our back from the beginning saying,
yeah.
Come on, you don't need the vines.
Never
just release the wine.
Like, you know, manufacturing and quick in and out.
Exactly. So it was only
you
on.
You had to tame them a little.
Yeah. So it was only in September of 2019 that we thought, okay, the wine is ready. We have a name. We have a label. We have a place that we can welcome people to and tell them our story. And so that just happened, and it's been an extraordinary journey of learning. Learning a lot about a culture, learning a lot about how to distribute to this culture, and also starting a story with people who know that they're going to get better at knowing wine, and our wine is going to get better because it's very young. You know, our vines are only 8 or 9 years old.
Right.
And some of them
old is new. I mean, yeah. Your family goes so far back, and you have old vines, but you have such a new venture.
Yeah.
But with such a slant. I'm curious, going backwards again. You come into the business, what do you feel you bring to the business? I mean, were they looking for youth or fresh perspective, or did your dad just say, I'm tired, you know, you got to do, I mean,
I think
it's on you now, and you have a different, I mean, you're young, you're a millennial.
It's all a question of eras. So my great uncle, Baron Elie, who took over right after the Second World War, you know, in 46, his era was really an era of reconstruction because Lafitte had been seized by the Germans,
right,
because we were a Jewish family. And so he basically took 30 years to reconstruct and actually have Lafitte make money, because at the time, you know, owning a winery was not something that...
You look at the brand and you don't realize that part of history, how difficult it was to everyone in
exactly.
every way.
Exactly. In the 70s, Lafitte was losing money. So it's, and some members of my family were saying, well, we should sell it, you know. And so it's important to remember those times, and it gives you a real humble attitude towards everything. And then my dad came in 1975, and his era was really the era of science and bringing in a chemical approach to protect the vines, because, you know, in Bordeaux there's a lot of humidity, so it's a real issue of how do you make
that
sure
that was the time after the World War where that's how the vineyards were treated.
And so 40 years later I come in, and I think my dad kind of felt that his era was the challenges of this time. He understood, of course, but he wasn't the right person to conduct them. And what are those challenges? The absolute transparency that the digital world requires from us. So we have to be absolutely impeccable and transparent on everything we do, and sustainability and where
so
we're going.
To sustainability and to talking about, you know, how your dad literally treated the vines, you've shifted away from that? You're moving more towards a sustainable, natural approach?
Absolutely. And it was, you can't blame what was happening in the 70s, because it was
Everybody was doing it.
Everybody was doing it. And that was just the movement. So, of course, now we're in an approach that is considering way more the way people were doing things in the last century, you know, and understanding the ecosystem and uprooting certain plots that never should have been planted.
Right.
And so, and thinking in terms of cover crops and approaches to protect the vines in a natural way. So it's really.
Do you want your kid running through a vineyard that's treated with pesticides? No.
I agree with you. You probably don't.
Right.
And so no, we're really on the path of converting certain of our vineyards to organic farming. And. And so it's been, that was one of the first challenges. And the second one.
So first challenge and a big one.
Huge, absolutely.
Second one
is, I think the other side of this is the digital world and how it creates this new marketplace where things are a lot closer and a lot more transparent. Like,
is that good, bad, hard?
It's hard. It's hard because you have Wine Searcher, and so you see the price of a wine online in 2 seconds.
The immediacy, the availability.
Yeah. And I think that's a real challenge to us is to think about distribution and how do we know our customers better? How do we get closer to them? And we have a lot to learn from the American winemakers with their direct-to-consumer systems, where they have the chance to know exactly who will drink the bottle and how. So I think that's also a real...
But isn't that changing? I mean, the market is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bordeaux and Bordeaux, to a lesser extent than Burgundy, has become expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the market has now shifted to millennials.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not spending that kind of money.
Well, the thing that I'm really trying to advocate, and that's what I tell my friends, is that once you have your first big paycheck, or once you become somebody, you can, of course, go and buy a Hermes bag. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
Everybody
wants to celebrate in their own way.
But
whether it's a Hermes bag, champagne, or a bottle of Lingerie, whatever.
But to me, like buying a bottle of Chateau Lafite or of Chateau L'Evangile of the birth year of your first kid and keeping it until he's like 20 or 18 to drink it, it's the most extraordinary thing you can do. So I believe that yes, what the wines we're producing are expensive, but you know, they're linked to such a special moment and such a special experience. If you actually keep a bottle.
We're not poo-pooing expensive wines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you eloquently stated why there's always a place. But, you know, some wines are getting expensive, but there's a place for everything.
Yeah, and we also have wines that are less expensive, like our Chilean estate, Los Vascos.
Let's run through the properties quickly, because I think people know the wines, but they don't necessarily know that it's, you know, part of the Domaine Baron
mm-hmm.
thing. So let's start in France. Flagship wine?
Chateau Lafite.
The Rothschild.
Then we have Chateau du Harminon, which is a fourth growth, which is neighboring of Chateau Lafite. And the same teams work on both chateaus, and
That's Duhartmilon.
Exactly.
Right. I want people to know.
Perfect. Then you cross the river to Chateau L'Evangile,
which is legendary, too.
Absolutely, which is where I learned a lot about winemaking and did all of my internships as a kid. So it's a wonderful place. Small estates, so 22 hectares. And so it's in the heart of Pomerol, so where the queen grape is Merlot. And so an absolute wonderful place, and you should all drink Chateau L'Evangile. And then if you go a bit further to Sauternes, which is an area where we produce licorice white wines, we own an estate that's called Chateau Rieussec.
Rieussec.
Exactly.
How do you pronounce it?
Rieussec.
It's funny, my friends pronounce it Rieussec.
Ah.
I go by you.
And
it's a wonderful Sauternes sweet wine.
Yeah, we also produce a dry white there because we've seen recently that it's difficult to...
Is that Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc?
Exactly.
Okay.
And we've seen recently that it's a difficult time for licorice white wines. There's really a little bit of a shift in fashions, and so people are not that interested in having that kind of wine, so...
I think it's coming back. You'll see.
We're hoping it's coming back, and we're doing everything we can for it to come back.
Well situated. All right, so is that... That's the Bordeaux?
Yeah, and then we have a little estate near, not too far from Chateau Rieussec, called Chateau Paradis Casseuil. That is a very good bargain for price, very qualitative red Bordeaux, little chateau.
All your expertise and technique is applied to that.
Exactly.
Perfect.
It's a 50-hectare vineyard that's very hilly and a beautiful, beautiful area of Bordeaux that's called Entre deux Mers, which means between two seas. So
Entre deux Mers.
M-E-R-S.
R-S, de Mer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Entre de Mer. And then in
People
Bordeaux...
hear this, I want them to, you know, I got to go out and try that, but what, what, you know...
And then in
it's
Bordeaux...
It's not your accent or anything. It's
okay.
People just don't, you know, they don't know the names.
And then in Bordeaux, we produce a range of more accessible wines that are called légendaires.
Right.
And we have, so, Pauillac, Médoc, Saint-Émilion, and the Bordeaux.
Those are larger production wines.
Those, yeah, and those, the objective...
And quality to price.
Yeah, and the objective is really, you know, sometimes Bordeaux can seem a bit complicated, like Bourgogne, with all of its premier grand cru des, and appellation des, and so this is a range of wine where we our objective is for them to be qualitative, easy to drink, and easy to understand, for it to be a first step into people learning the differences in Bordeaux.
Right.
So that was important because, as you say, you know, we do make very expensive wines, but we also want to make approachable ones for people to go towards loving wines in Bordeaux.
It's important you do that.
Yeah, and it's a real challenge because one thing I've noticed is that Bordeaux has been a little bit like seen as old, and people don't want to drink the wines that their parents were drinking, so they could think, oh, Bordeaux, it's boring.
Right.
So it's important for us to have that kind of wine, right, to have younger people think that Bordeaux is cool.
And then you're in the Languedoc?
Yeah, in Languedoc we have an estate that's called Château d'Ossière, that is in organic farming, and that's...
more typical of the region to farm, yeah, organically, right?
Yeah, exactly, and it's a blend of Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, and Carignan, which is quite classical over there. And we have a Château wine, which is our icon, and we also have a Rosé that is very qualitative and that we're really working hard on.
And then South America?
South America, we have one wine that's Los Vascos, that is an estate in Chile in the Colchagua Valley. It's a huge estate and it's an absolutely incredible place. It's where we produce Cabernet, Chilean reds, but also very premium Le 10 de Los Vascos,
right,
which is our premium label. And it's a venture that my father started about 30 years ago. And it's been a very fun adventure.
It's a very well-known brand.
Yeah.
It's
very well-known in the U.S., and I think it's now our duty to make it resonate with younger generations, because it was kind of a wine that was very drunk 10
right,
years ago, or 10 years ago, and now we have to kind of tell the story of that estate
right,
again. That's
reposition
a challenge.
A little, yeah, market and all that. You may be able to succeed in social media.
Yeah.
All right, did we cover all the wineries?
No, in Argentina we have a project called Bodegas Caro with the Catena family.
We just saw Laura Catena as you were coming in, right?
So that's a fun blended wine of Malbec and Cabernet Sauvignon. So we're really bringing in two cultures and two approaches to winemaking, and making it into something that we think is better than the sum of what they are. So
you didn't forget that Malbec was one of the five blending grapes in Bordeaux.
It used to, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, we used to have some in
Not
Lafitte.
Not so much now.
Yeah. We used to have some in Chateau Lafitte. We had Malbec.
Yeah.
Malbec plots.
So that's everything?
And our Chinese winery.
Oh, right, which we talked about.
Long Dai.
We jumped into that earlier.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about being a woman in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel anything about being a woman in the business? Do you feel people don't look at you the same way? I mean, you have a lot of things backing you, your dad's support, the name of the, you know, winery, the reputation, but there's not a lot of women prominently in wine, owners, even winemakers, getting better.
Mm-hmm.
But is that a challenge to you, or you don't see or feel it? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I'd say the main challenge is being maybe a woman and my age. It's a kind of a double thing, because when I walk into an event, people think I'm the intern. And
well, that's a fair part of the old story in a restaurant is a woman sommelier comes over and the guy says, could you send the sommelier over?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the age is definitely part of the answer, separate, being a woman, putting it together.
So I've always had a fun time with it, or I just like go along with the conversation of people asking me, what do I do at this date, and when can I go get the boss and things like that, or but it's actually normal, and I think it's also normal in the first years when you're running an estate that you have to have that challenge, and my main ammunition against that is showing that I know what I'm talking about, and showing that I'm very open to having people tell me their stories, and having people at the estate explain what they do. And my job before as a journalist was asking questions,
right,
and I've never stopped.
Right.
What I do right now and what I've been doing for the past 3 years is continuously asking, but how was it before? Why are we doing it this way? How can we change it to make it better? What would you like to change for your position to be more interesting? So it's basically constantly interrogating the situation for it to be better.
So does that mean you are or have to work harder than a guy, maybe? I mean, that
could be
the crux of the whole thing, which is not fair and why, but...
I don't know if I have to work harder. The good thing is that I have a team of people who are really benevolent to what I do because they know I work. They know I work hard and they know I'm really behind.
It trickles down.
Yeah, and I know they know I'm really behind them to push them and for them to be better and for all of us to work together. So I think that gives you respect, you know.
Right, you create a culture.
Yeah.
That you want to be a part of and you
exactly.
want everyone to be a part of it.
Yeah, and also a culture of dialogue and of it being a little bit less hierarchical and all this. So it's I think more than just in the wine business, it's globally how do you look into running a company, you know. And,
right.
And I think France has a lot to learn from other countries
and
in that
I
front.
I think with China and with you there, the word global is mm-hmm. an important aspect of where you want to take the company, right? Mm-hmm. It always boggles my mind when you have a product, any product, a product like yours, and we just ticked off all the wineries around the world. It's just amazing. How do you keep the product? You know, there's excellence everywhere. You know, how do you control that? I mean, that's people, right?
It's completely people, and it's...
Because you can't be in South America and the Languedoc at the same time,
no.
But you want to...
Basically, what I'd say is that it's knowing what you want to see not change. It's knowing in your soul and intuitively what are the core things that shouldn't change, and having the freedom to actually... push things to evolve that you...
So you have to have the vision.
Yeah.
It has to be clear.
Has to be completely clear.
You have to
clear.
Execute it.
Yeah, and Lafitte never followed fashion. And that's why we are where we are today. You know, at the time of where Robert Parker was having everyone make very powerful wines with really big shoulders, we never went in that direction. We were like, no, that's not our style. Lafitte is
and
what...
Bordeaux succumbed to that.
Yeah, and Bordeaux succumbed to that.
On.
And in L'Evangile, we succumbed to that a little bit more because Right Bank was more open
right.
to change. And so, but in Chateau Lafitte, it never changed. You know, it's like the terroir was teaching us to do something. We went in that direction. And that I'm really happy to have learned that from my father and from
right.
the people I've been working with. It's basically like trust your gut and trust what you do best. And I think that's the most important thing. It's like you can be excellent, but you have to be excellent your way.
Right. You have to have your own compass
yeah.
and follow it. Do you sleep at night?
I do.
Do you get some sleep? I'm always curious, too.
I wake up in the middle of the night when we have frost alerts.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So when we in April in
Bordeaux. Does something go off or something in this?
Yeah, in
frost alert.
No, in April in Bordeaux we have short nights because you can have to get up at 4 in the morning and go put candles in L'Evangile all around to make sure that our grapes don't frost. So sometimes we don't sleep.
All right, I have to let you go. I also wanted to mention that at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, you are the honored vintner. Every year, the whole, you know, mass of all the wine people, they select one person and you're it, and that's a nice thing to be and be part of, and I know you're down here for all good reasons. Before I let you go, when you're not drinking your own wines, what do you like to drink?
I love Loire whites.
You do?
Yeah.
Chenin,
I think,
okay.
is a really interesting
love
grape.
It.
What do I love? I love Rhône wines.
North or south? Do you like the
both.
Grenache? You do?
Both.
So you like a Saint-Joseph as much as a...
Yeah, a Château Rayas.
Yeah.
So I'm,
oh, those
no.
are all great wines.
Yeah.
Okay,
no.
Give me one more.
And what else? What have I been drinking
I'm surprised
recently?
You didn't say champagne.
I don't drink that much champagne. I love Burgundy wines, but...
you don't drink as much.
No, my dad, every birthday and every Christmas, I ask my dad to give me 6 bottles of Burgundy.
So that's how you're building your collection?
So I have a little cellar.
Your dad's back? Okay.
So I have a little cellar of Burgundy wines. It's every year becoming a little bit bigger, and so I open key bottles on key occasions. So I love Burgundy, and so I'm really sensitive
to what
they do.
Bordeaux has gone through some changes. Mm. Generational changes, sustainability, price, but Burgundy certainly has it's just structured so differently.
Completely.
I mean, that's another show. I got to let you go. I want to thank our guest, Saskia de Rothschild from Domaine Baron de Roth. Baron Zur Rothschild. We discussed all the different wines she makes, and they're fairly ubiquitous. So you can Google them or walk in somewhere and see them, you know. But I want to thank you for coming in and spending some time with us. And also thanks for coming down to the wine festival and helping these guys raise a lot of money. And I hope, if you'll answer my email, to see you one day in France.
For sure, okay. For sure.
All right, thank you very much, Saskia.
Thanks.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its order hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/grapenation.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey on the Heritage Radio Network. We are at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. Our guest is fourth generation winemaker, Dr. Laura Catena. Welcome to The Grape Nation, Laura.
Thank you, Sam.
Just a sidebar, we're going into our fourth year of The Grape Nation. And I wanted to point out that I think it was September of 2016, Laura Catena was the first guest ever on The Grape Nation. Now,
yay!
You certainly, I've evolved. You just continue to, you know, be great. So it's great to sit down with you again. All right, so I was invited back to the festival, and it's a great charity, and they bring great winemakers down. And when I found out you were here again, you know, I made sure we got together. And part of that is, I don't even know if we can cover everything. There's a lot going on with you. And you can help me slot it or, you know, how you want to break down. I want to talk about the book. I want to talk about your play. I want to talk about some newer wine projects. You know, we always have to talk about Catena in Argentina. So where do you want to start?
Well, maybe we can start with Malbec, which is, you know, the variety that my country is known for. It was first planted by my great-grandfather who came from Italy to Argentina in 1902. It was brought from France to Argentina in 1852. So this very ancient grape dates back to, you know, Middle Ages, actually initially with the Romans.
Right.
It was planted in Gaul, you know, the old France, and basically became lost in the old world, because after phylloxera, it was a delicate grape. So phylloxera is this little plague, this insect that chews at the roots of vines. And interestingly, it was brought from America to France. But, you know, I once said to an American, don't you feel a little guilty about, you know, the phylloxera? And you know what he said to me? Actually, it was the French who brought it. And it is a true fact. If you read, there's this great book about phylloxera, that the French brought the American vines for ornamental purposes. So they brought them, and they would put them, you know, in window displays. And then a few people said, oh, it's so pretty, I'll put it in my vineyard. And then what happened was that the phylloxera insect did not harm the American vines, but it did harm the Vitis vinifera, the European vine. But, you know, nobody knew that this was going to happen.
Right.
And, well, The end of the story is that basically all the vineyards in Europe are destroyed, and then this American from Missouri, this entomologist, comes up with the idea of grafting American rootstock with Vitis vinifera so that we can still have our Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot.
And it's hardier. But with
the, right, but the roots are from an American vine, which is resistant to phylloxera. And that's how, basically, viticulture is saved in the world. Interestingly, though, in Argentina, we have a little phylloxera, but it doesn't propagate. So it's not a big problem for us, but it is a problem in Europe, in most countries.
Is that climate and environment driven? You know, moisture or not necessarily?
So there's a lot of theories. So in Argentina, it's quite dry in Mendoza, in the wine country by the Andes. And also we have these very well-drained soils with a decent amount of sand. We also have limestone and gravel and all kinds of things. But generally, with a dry weather and some sand in your soils, the phylloxera does not propagate as much. However, we do have phylloxera. And there's other parts. There's parts of Australia where the phylloxera does not propagate.
Right.
But most of the vineyards in the world right now are planted on American rootstocks. In Argentina, only 5% of vineyards are planted on American rootstocks.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyhow,
is that as low as anywhere? Pretty much.
I think Chile is also highly ungrafted, but Chile has probably more grafted vines than Argentina does.
Okay.
But continuing on the story of Malbec, it comes to Argentina. It is basically lost in Europe because it was very sensitive to cold and they had this little ice age, so they didn't replant it, even if it was, you know, just as important as Cabernet Sauvignon in the Medoc in Bordeaux, where the famous, you know, the Grand Crus come from. But it comes to Argentina. Somehow it does well. I think there's something about the soils, the sunlight, the mountain climate, and Argentina embraces it, but it doesn't see the rest of the world for a long time because
which you have a big hand in. But I'm curious about something.
Yeah.
When it was brought to Argentina, and I don't think you explained this, why Malbec? Why didn't they bring, you know, Cab Sauv or, you know, Petite France? I mean, if one country is associated singularly with a grape, it's about, why Malbec?
So actually, the viticulturalist, who was a Frenchman hired by the Argentine government, the one who brought all the cuttings from Europe, because we had been making wine in Argentina since the 16th century, from varieties like criollas and similar to the Mission grape, Torrontés. Which actually is seeing a revival right now.
We can talk about that later. Delicious.
But basically, these classic French and some Italian varieties were brought in the middle of the 19th century by this French viticulturalist. And actually, he brought Cabernet Sauvignon, he brought Malbec, he brought Sangiovese. I mean, a lot of different cuttings were brought. Nobody really knows why Malbec was planted more than everything else. And I have two theories. The first theory is that Malbec was the most important variety in the Medoc. And Argentina at that time was going through a sort of French love affair. And they were actually importing to Argentina a lot of Bordeaux wine. So I think that they were saying, hey, this is the most important grape in France. It has the status. We want the best grape. So let's plant that. My other theory is that it also did better than other varieties. And the truth is, in Argentina, you can plant a lot of varieties and they'll make great, you know, good wine, great wine. Malbec makes exceptional wine in many different places in Argentina. So I think there is what we call a terroir match, you know, when the soil and the climate actually match the variety. You know, like it's like the immigrant that found its home in the new world.
Right.
I think it is one of those stories. So I think it's a two-pronged answer to why Malbec.
I think you're right, and you know they both sound very logical. And if you fast forward, I mean, I think, and this is a compliment straight up, if you talk about the acceptance and prominence of Malbec, I think you could put that on the back of your dad and you, as far as being ambassadors and making quality wines and exposing the world to it. And I'll give you an example. I was in Uruguay in June. I forgot to tell you. And Tanat is associated with Uruguay.
That's right.
And it's just, there's just nobody there, you know, like your dad or you that is taking, you know, this on. It could happen, and that's another discussion. But I think you have a very important hand in Malbec.
Well, you know, thank you for the compliment. And it is true that my father and I have sort of tirelessly traveled the world talking about Malbec, but also really working on how do we make a Malbec that's as good as a great Cabernet Sauvignon, as a great, you know, Syrah, as a great Pinot Noir. And some of the work we did was actually research work. And, you know, this is something that's a little controversial in wine, talking about the science and the art. Most people would like wine to be all art. You know, like you walk into your winery, you grab some grapes, you step on them, and out comes this
art
gorgeous...
Art and romance.
Art and romance. And there is actually a lot of art and romance in wine. And we're going to talk later about my
book. But that's not necessarily how you continue to make great wine.
No, and you know, and I'm fascinated by the art and the romance and the history of wine. However, how did we make Malbec, which had been forgotten by the world, by the French, by the whole world? When I first went around, you know, as a doctor, because, you know, that's my other job as a physician, but occasionally I would go help the winery to sell. And I would go around with a bottle of Malbec in the early 90s. And I would go into a store, the sommelier would taste the wine, and he'd say, oh, this wine is wonderful, but I can't buy it because nobody knows what Malbec is, and I can't sell it. This was, you know,
a light bulb wine.
Early mid-90s. Right. People didn't know Malbec.
Not that long ago.
So, but what did my father and I do? We started studying Malbec, and we found that we had these massal, that means very diverse selections of Malbec, that have been lost to Europe, but were only remaining in Argentina. And we started selecting the best plants, replanting them, studying what are the best soils, you know, how we should do the pruning, what cover crops to use. And we did a lot of research at what we call the Catena Institute of Wine, which I founded in 1995. We learned why high altitude has more sunlight and makes the skins thicker and the wines more concentrated. So we've done all this research for quality, and I think that's a big part of why we've been able to make really age-worthy Malbec that's very profound.
You've committed to that, and I think beyond what you're saying, I mean, the acclaim is there. You know, the criticism is very positive. If people go by ratings, the ratings are high.
Well, we had last year our first 100-point wine by Parker. We've had 100-point wines by Suckling. That was a dream.
Those are all great, but you put your wine next to other great wines with people, and they're right there. That's
Thank you.
You know, you know, what you've accomplished. So, of course, you couldn't sit on your hands as being a spokesperson and ambassador for Malbec. You had to make a play about it.
Yes.
Right? Which is, if people know you, and I've gotten to know you through the years, it makes total sense. So just as a side thing, tell me what that, because it ties into what
we just talked
about.
So, you know, I wanted people to know this fantastic history of Malbec. And I know I'm biased, but I do think it's the variety. Thank you. It's the variety with the most fascinating history, because it literally almost went extinct, but it was revived, and then it became world famous again, but now from Argentina. And so actually my sister, who's a historian, gave me this idea of doing a label with four women who tell the history of Malbec. So the first woman is Eleanor of Aquitaine, you know, this famous queen of France and England.
Right.
And she lived in the 12th century, and she drank Malbec supposedly at her wedding. Then the second woman is the immigrant who came to Argentina. So there were 6 million Europeans from Italy and Spain. One of them was my great-grandmother, Ana Mucheta, who came from Le Marque to Argentina. And she was... who my great-grandfather called her his vine whisperer, because when she planted a vineyard, it did well. And one time, actually, she was pregnant,
so he had
somebody else plant the vineyard, and he said that vineyard never took. And so he thought she was the secret to a well-planted vineyard. And then the third woman is actually not a woman. She is the insect Phylloxera. But why is she a female? Because the reason that Phylloxera could not be eradicated,
right,
it's right here, is because...
That's Phylloxera? I'm going to take a picture of the bottle
yes,
and post it.
It's a skeleton. So the reason why they couldn't exterminate Phylloxera, the plague, was that it mostly exists in the female form. and they couldn't find the males. And the way you stop a plague is by stopping the reproductive cycle, and they couldn't stop it. So actually, even the villain of the story is female. And then the fourth figure is my sister, and she wanted it to be me, but I'm the older sister, and I won, so it's her. And she's sitting on the world, showing South America and our winery, which has the shape of a pyramid. But now about the play. So I wanted this story that's told in the label, told in some other way. And I have a brother-in-law, my sister's husband, who is a playwright. And he wrote a play that we are now touring all over the U.S. We've done it in Europe, theaters, wine stores, restaurants, and it's been a great success. And it tells the history of Malbec through a single woman who acts the various women of Malbec.
It's such a unique idea. I mean, novel, too.
Well, you know, it's really fun because at first I was not sure that people would like it because, you know, when I say at my house, I have, you know, two sons, a daughter and a husband. I say, does anybody want to go to the theater? You know, the initial reaction is immediately, no, we hate theater. It's so boring. I love theater. But I thought, hey, is this something that's going to be appealing to a wider audience? But it is. And it's, you know, it's only 20 minutes, so it's fast. People get so engaged. They're so excited at the end. But I still haven't been able to get my kids to go see it.
Well, you're on a schedule. I know that you're... We're in Florida right now. You're going to finish up in the state, and then you're going to go back on the road to California, and then you'll be in the Northeast.
Well, first I'm going to Argentina because it's harvest right now.
Right, but
yeah, I'm going to be in right.
You're going to finish in Florida, I guess, January, Feb.
Yeah.
Then you're going back.
Yes.
And then when you're done with harvest.
Yes. Then we're taking the tour to the East Coast. Yes.
So. If people are hearing this and they're like, wow, that sounds pretty cool, how do they find out more about it? Is there any way to do it?
Well, we are posting on our Instagram account, our Facebook.
Okay, so let's tell people what the Instagram account is.
So for Catena, it's at catenawines.com, and that's C-A-T-E-N-A. Do you know what Catena means in Italian, Sam?
I should know by now.
And in Latin. Most people, I tell them and then they forget.
I think I knew this and I forgot it. Tell me.
So it means chain. And I always think of it as the chain of mountains.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So actually, most people that sell our wine don't know this because they actually think it's a Spanish word. They want to put the little thing on the
typically,
end. Yeah, but it's actually Italian.
If you go back to the history, there's a lot of immigration to Argentina, Italians, Germans,
the
whole thing. So if you're interested, I think it would be fun to follow Catena Wines and Laura anyway, so you'll be able to find out about that. When we sat down, I said we have a lot to talk about. You framed Malbec so eloquently, and you featured it in a play, and besides being a doctor and raising kids and making a wine, you wrote a book.
That's right. So.
And it's an interesting book. I just got it. And if you love wine, it kind of hits everything you like about it. So answer the sort of typical mandatory questions. When did you write it? Why did you write it? And let's talk about what it is.
Okay, so my first book was Vino Argentino that I think we spoke about in our last interview, which is basically
still
a guide.
Still around, still a great guide.
Still around, guide to, you know, all the wine country of Argentina. It has lists of wineries.
Have you updated it? I mean, it's something
Yeah, so we did do an update of some of the information. So it's pretty current right now.
Okay.
The restaurants I recommend are still open.
Right.
But it probably could use another update. That was published in 2010.
I just sat with Jan Cease Robinson and Hugh Johnson. They just did their 8th World Atlas.
Amazing.
But it was 7 years before, so you don't have to get nervous.
Okay, thank you. But anyhow, so Gold in the Vineyards. Actually, just like Vino Argentino.
So the book is called Gold in the Vineyards.
Yes. Okay. So I basically, with Vino Argentino, with my first book, I wanted to find a writer to write it. And then I talked to a bunch of people, and I didn't find anybody that was passionate enough to write the book. And so I ended up writing it myself. And this second book, Gold in the Vineyards, which is a book about the 12 most illustrated, when I say illustrious, you know,
right.
The most famous vineyards in the world, and it's an illustrated book.
Stop there for a second. So 12 of the most illustrious vineyards, you probably won't get much of an argument, but the 12 picked by who and based on what?
Okay, so they are picked by me.
Okay, so I knew that was the answer.
Forgive me if it's a bit arrogant, perhaps.
Well, you have the chops to, you know, get into that game. And what was the criteria?
So the criteria were, you know, wines that have perdured through time, that have sort of a world recognition, that people know them. You know, I go to all the wine shows, and, you know, those wines are revered. Why are they revered? Well, it's a combination of their particular taste, because they have a taste of a certain place. Usually they're age-worthy. The most famous wines in the world are generally age-worthy. And usually there is an exciting story behind how that vineyard was founded, what happened to the family, how did the family, you know, conduct their business. And I chose family wineries because literally the most famous vineyards in the world are owned by families.
You know, I'm going to tick a few off. So the Rothschilds,
yes,
Antinori, and Rothschild and Antinori make a lot of different wines. Spain and Lopez de Heredia, U.S., Harlan, Italy, Gaia, bunch of French, Burgundy, Aubert de Valaine, La Flave, Guigal in the Northern Rhone. I mean, these are all, like I said, you're not going to get much of an argument. These are storied wineries. And
storied, that's a good word.
They use the word storied because there's a story
behind
it. So Laura picks these. And then you what? You get out on the road and you start sitting down with the principals?
So in many cases, I knew the families and I had already talked to them, you know, at wine shows or, you know, Piero Antinori, I've known him my whole wine life.
Throw the idea around?
Not really, because I didn't want to do the standard winery book. I wanted some of the stories that maybe people don't know. And I think those are the stories that wine drinkers want to know. They want to know about the struggles and, you know, the things that went well, the things that went badly. And I wanted to kind of pick through the stories that I wanted to include, but they had to be true. So I did a lot of research in order for the stories to be true. And I also wanted to talk about soil and climate in an illustrated way, because I think that, you know, if you write, you know, okay, so we have limestone, and this is the soil pH, and this is the harvest date. That's really boring. But if I could put it in an illustration. So, for example, you know, did you know that Chateau Yquem, the famous sweet wine from Sauternes, all the grapes are harvested by women? They only hire women. You know, they're totally sexist, of course. And why is that? Because they have small hands. And you need to pick through the botrycized grapes. And so there were all these little tidbits that I felt that people didn't know. Also, did you know that the real person who made Yquem famous was a woman? Why did she become the owner? Because her husband died literally a few days after they got married when he fell off a horse.
So she had no hand in it until he got out of the way.
Right, but in a way,
it
shouldn't be that way. But actually, the story of most women back then, the only way a woman became the boss was when the husband died.
Right.
Nobody ever left the woman in charge, except for Eleanor of Aquitaine. She was actually left in charge by her father, but that's because she didn't have brothers.
Which is another circumstance. Listen,
yeah.
You and I could do an entire show or two about women and wine.
Yeah.
And why not more, and, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it's a point well taken.
Well, no, but actually, in the book, I made a deliberate effort to highlight both the female and the male stories. So, actually, you'll see in the book that I have as many heroes as sheroes.
So you made it a point to make sure that all sides were covered.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
I also mentioned, I didn't mention Henschke, which is a great Australian.
I love those wines.
So it's fair to say that we're looking at somebody in the business that takes an insider's look, because you're on the inside of the business, that has properly selected these storied vineyards. And the perspective is not just the story, but to find interesting aspects about that particular winery, right?
Yeah, and I also talk about things like, you know, their ratings, the scores. And, you know, right now there's all this controversy about, oh, you know, we don't like the 100-point system. But actually, a lot of the fame of some of these properties has come out of some of these ratings. So I'm trying to bring the complete...
Well, I don't think you could deny it, but that doesn't mean there's not a discussion about it.
Exactly.
It has its place in the wine world.
Yes.
You know,
and I also agree with the discussion. I think that it's too narrow to think of just the score.
Right.
That's why I include in the book something about some of the ratings that the wineries received, plus their whole history behind them, and plus what's the explanation for that special taste right. of that wine.
That's really the reality of it. Did you have to narrow it down to a dozen? Were there a handful of wineries more that you could have gone on and on with the book, or how did you get to the final selection process?
Well, I think I could have probably done twice as many easily.
But with the same gravity and quality and all of that?
I think twice as many I could have easily. Maybe 10 times more, that would have been harder.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always think of Paris and the Eiffel Tower. If you talk to anybody in the world, you say, Paris, what's your first thought? Eiffel Tower. So what are the Eiffel Tower equivalents of good, these regions?
Good way to
And, you know, for example, for Bordeaux, it's Lafitte. For Burgundy, it's Romanée-Conti. So, yes, there's many other famous properties that people in the wine world know about. But what's the Eiffel Tower? And that's kind of what I was looking for.
I think you nailed it. So the book is really, really new. I mean, it just came out, right?
Well, so it came out in Argentina at the end of 2018 in December, right before the holidays. It actually did. 2018. Oh. So a little over a year ago. It did really well in Argentina. And so that's why I decided to translate into English. And so I translated it myself. I had an editor, you know, read over it. And then Quarto Publishing is a distributor in Canada, US, UK, and English-speaking Europe. And I am actually working on a Chinese edition. Yes.
That's a big market.
Yeah.
I mean, all those wines are of high interest specifically.
So I'm working on that. That's probably not going to happen for a couple of years, but that's the next part of the project.
So to our audience, where do they get it? Is it the standard Amazon?
You'll be able to get it in Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're also going to target some, you know, stories that have gifts. Hopefully some wine stores will sell the books. Although every time I go to a wine store and I say, are you interested in books? People look at me funny like, no. People just want to buy wine.
That's how you sort of get your finger on the pulse. Who gives a crap, who doesn't, you know, where you could find some leeway. It's kind of
But this book is actually a fun read. I tell people, listen, get a glass of wine. You can just look at the drawings.
It is. I did get a copy, and it is a fun read. And when I asked you how do you narrow it down to 12, it just gave me the idea, why can't you do volume 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever?
Well, like the Japanese
manga. It doesn't diminish
manga.
The importance of the first one. Yeah.
No, we could. Yeah. Are you familiar with the Drops of God? What's it called? The Japanese manga?
Is that a particular one? I mean, I know a manga
drops.
Is.
So there was a manga
volumes?
About wine that was The Drops of God or something like that. And it is very well known in Japan and Asia. In China, they read it as well. And it is the best writing about wine there is. Sam, you've got to read this. Yeah, you can find it in English and in French.
Tell everyone again what it's called.
Well, I'm not 100% sure, but it's...
Drops of wine.
The Drops of God.
Drops of God.
The Drops of God. But basically, look up Japanese manga about wine, and you'll see it. And it's beautiful writing. It's about a competition between two psalms for one of their father's cellar. And they basically go on these journeys trying to decipher what a certain wine is, a secret wine. And it is fascinating. There's love stories. There's scandal. It's amazing.
That's very cool.
Yes.
I think most people probably have not seen it. Continuing on, I notice that, listen, you make a lot of wine. But your working on two newer projects. You're kind of shepherding these projects. You want to talk about them? One is something that's been around Domain Nico, but you're doing something specific with it. And the other one, pronounce it for me again,
La Marchigiana.
All right, let's start with that. That is a
natural wine.
All right, so here's two questions, and we'll answer the second one another time. Why are you making a natural wine? And I guess at some point you can convince me that all your other wines have a slant or an eye towards sustainability and the land being important and all of that. But let's talk about this project.
Yeah, so...
I mean, you're talking no sulfur.
You know, one of the things that is so wonderful about having your own family winery is that you can do things that are perhaps, you know, sort of not commercially... You don't know how well they're going to do commercially, but you can do them because you can take a risk, and there's no board.
Follow a passion. That,
exactly, you can follow a passion. So, I met Alice Firing, who you know is a very well-known writer about natural wines.
Show a couple times.
You know, wonderful woman. We actually have a connection, which is that her first cousin was my boss at the hospital at UCSF.
Wow.
So we have this you know, really kind of strong family connection. And I read Alice's books. I even went to her home and tasted some of these natural wines. And I thought they were really interesting. You know, a lot of people say, you know, natural wines are disgusting. I think they have these kind of oxidized flavors often that are interesting. I like them. And I also find that they're harder to drink fast because they're a little more bitter and not as smooth on the mouth. You drink them a little more slowly. And that my theory for why people say they get less headaches or less dehydration is because they're drinking more slowly. Because actually, if you think of the sulfites...
They're also a little lower alcohol.
A little lower alcohol. Yeah, ours are too. Because actually, the sulfites in a glass of wine are like having one, preserved peach, you know, one dried fruit. So, but anyhow, I actually thought these wines were interesting. And I went back home, and I was talking to my dad and telling him about, you know, the tinajas, the cuevries, you know, the clay pots, and how the no sulfites. And so my dad says, what? You're saying this is a winemaking methodology from Georgia in Russia, you know, near Russia? He said, this is how my grandfather made wine.
In, like, Amphora?
In Argentina, yes.
And all that? You call it a tinaja.
A tinaja, yeah. So in Argentina... From the 16th century to the 19th century, wine was made in tinajas, and it was kept underground.
So you didn't tell him anything new.
No. So he's like, wait a second. You know, what? What are you talking about? Natural wine?
This is basically
how my great grandfather. And he said, and he made wine like that in Italy. And actually, the innovation, when he started making wine in Argentina, was to start to use barrels. But his initial method and how wine was made in Argentina for four centuries was in this traditional method. So I thought, wow, that's really interesting because nobody knows about that. Why don't we make this variety called Criolla, which is this pink variety, in the natural wine process, and it's going to taste like the wine that was made in Argentina for four centuries. And we tried this out, and the wine is delicious. It's like the best rosé you've ever had.
The grape is Criolla?
Criolla.
What's Criolla Chica?
Okay, so C-R-I-O-L-L-A. L-A. Chica just means small Criolla.
Okay. And that is...
So that's basically... It's a pink grape.
It's pink.
And it usually is used for table wine. But actually, when you make it in the natural wine method, it has this kind of slight oxidation. It's beautiful pink color. It's very light but high acid.
Good profile for a natural.
And you know like that little herbalness that we like about Sauvignon Blanc? It's got that too. So it's the wine that, for example, if you're having, you know, I don't know, like soufflé or an empanada, which is like with the crust, a quiche.
And the meat.
Like something
the
that has a lot of fat.
And the crust, right.
And that, you know, you could have a red wine with it, but a white would be better. You drink it with this pink stuff, and it's much more complex and textured than a regular rosé. You know, it's really interesting. So we've made that variety. We've also made a Bonarda, Chardonnay. We're trialing with Malbec, but it's a fun project, and it's called La Marchigiana because La Marchigiana, which means woman from Le Marche, was one of my great grandfather's original brands because he was from Le Marche.
Ah. So, great connection.
And it has the same original drawing that he used on his barrels that he used to sell wine. in the early 20th century.
That's the good news. I guess the bad news is you're not making a lot, and it's not that easy to get here. What are our future plans for that?
Well, you know, right now we're making it in tinajas. We can make the wine also in stainless steel. We need to get more tinajas. We have gotten more tinajas.
Not sure.
And you know, actually, one of the issues is, can we sell this wine? So the rosé, the criolla, every person I've tasted on this wine goes crazy. They say, I love this wine.
Excuse my ignorance, but in Mendoza, which is a cosmopolitan city now, Buenos Aires, even go, you know, Rio, is there a natural wine following or uprising like there is in the States?
No, it's very early.
It's
so
early
there's a few places. It's very early. People don't understand the wine.
So you're ahead of the curve on this.
Yeah, and people might think there's a flaw in the wine, which, you know, if you're used to traditional wine. Yeah, but I actually think the wines are interesting. So if we can do well with this wine and sell it, we would basically save a whole region of Mendoza. And remember what we were talking earlier, and I was telling you, I think I'm making a bigger impact in the world as a winemaker than as a physician. So this whole area in the east of Mendoza is very poor because everybody moved to the Uco Valley, to the cooler climate. Mm-hmm. And this whole traditional area has been sort of abandoned. There's this beautiful old vine, abandoned vineyards. If we can make something interesting with the criolla, with this natural wine style, which we've already shown that we can do it in a small scale, but maybe we can make more, it would actually change the lives of thousands and thousands of people.
So the prospects are good, and for good.
I hope so.
Sounds interesting. And then one of, you name all your wines after your kids, you're starting to focus on making a little more Pinot Noir, right?
Yes.
You found out that it's not a bad place to grow Pinot Noir.
So, you know, why Pinot Noir?
It's Domaine Nico.
Yes. Domaine Nico Pinot Noir from five different sites. So why Pinot Noir in Mendoza? It's simply because my father and I used to go to France together when I was not planning to go work with him. It was just, I was going as his translator because, you know, I was in medical school, but I studied French. I was one credit short of minoring in French at Harvard for undergrad because I took so many French classes. So I would go with my dad as a translator, and I fell in love with the Pinot Noirs from Burgundy. And then when my father was starting his whole high quality, you know, let's make Argentine wines that can stand with the best of the world, I said, why not Pinot Noir? And so we brought some of the best clones of Pinot Noir from France to Mendoza in the early 90s. And I've been making the Luca Pinot Noir for many years, which is delicious. And it's a blend of different sites. That's what it was for several years, and then now it's coming from one place in Gualtachari. We also sell other Pinot Noirs in Argentina under other labels. But then I thought, one year in 2016, it was a very cool vintage. I tasted with Alejandro Vigil, the Catena winemaker, and Roy Urbieta, who is the Domenico winemaker, yes, who works at the Catena Institute. We tasted all the separate parcels of Pinot Noir, and they were so incredibly different. And this cold year made them even more different. And, you know, we say it's criminal to blend these wines. Yes, we'll make a beautiful Pinot Noir if we blend them, but we have to keep them separate. And that's where the idea of making a separate label.
Site-specific.
And Domenico, Nico is my daughter's nickname, but it's also my great-grandfather's name, Nicola. They share their name.
So when you talk about sites, are we talking about like Burgundy where they're not that far from each other? Or are we talking all over the place?
Yeah, so all these sites are very close to each other. They are maybe 20 miles from each other. Very different soils. Some have gravelly soils, some have more limestone, some are more shallow, more deep. They have different exposures. They have different altitudes, so more or less sunlight, more cool climate, less cool climate. So, and they're very different sites, and the flavors are very different, really different.
It's interesting.
They go from 4,000 feet elevation to 5,000 feet elevation, and that's a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, you know that from making your cabs and
Malbecs. Yeah, the idea was to look at places where Pinot Noir did well. We did not plant Pinot Noir in warmer climates because Pinot Noir does not do well in warmer climates. So what I'm trying to show is, what is the taste of cool climate, high altitude Pinot Noir in Argentina? And I think the wines are very elegant. They have beautiful minerality. They're very site-specific. Are you going to start seeing a lot of Pinot Noir from Argentina? You know, there's some really interesting stuff from Patagonia.
Yeah.
There's not a ton planted, so it's not going to become some sort of big thing, but if you can get one of these bottles, it's a fun project.
Yeah, I think you should look out for that Domaine Nico, and it's nice to see you concentrating on that. Laura, we have to wrap up. I guess I can't let you leave without asking how things are at Bottega Catena Zapata, and hoping your parents are well.
Yes, my father just turned 80 this year.
Wow.
He's still very involved with the winery. My mom, you know, she runs a software company. And they're busy.
That's where you got all your values from. In case you don't know, Laura is also a doctor, a medical doctor, and has been spending a good chunk of her time when it's not harvest in Northern California as an emergency room physician and other things. So I think the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah, but their priority right now is the grandkids. They have 8 grandkids, and that's their priority. And I'm very happy to work really hard so that they can have time to spend with their grandkids.
That's the best. It's all about
they deserve
family.
It.
And listen, I've been down there, and my son has been down there, and I've seen pictures. It's just a beautiful thing when the whole family's together, when
yes.
the kids are running around. There's a lot of musicians in the family.
Yes.
People
yes.
are playing in the yards.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing. Well, listen, it's always great to see you. I'm glad that we got to sit down and spend time here. And, you know, it was fun spending other time with you here. And I wish you well with all these projects. And I hope to see you soon. And I want to thank Laura Catena. From Bodega Catena Zapata, but there's so many other things which we talked about. I'm Sam Van Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.